are back to talk about 2009. Last time we had an hour-long discussion or so about some of the key movies of 2009. And this time we are going to give our top six and bottom six of the year and then also talk about a couple other things. So I'm Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller.
So let's talk about our worst movies of the year before getting to the best movies of the year. Maybe we can end on a better note. I came up with six movies that I think were pretty terrible, and you apparently loved the year 2009 so much that you couldn't get to six, though? Is that true?
My big problem is I just don't care about most of the movies of 2009. I have a big who-cares attitude about so much of this year.
So you don't hate them enough to trash them?
Well, right, a little bit.
Okay. Well,
that's how I feel about Transformers 2, which is, like, is it even really a movie?
Yeah,
I don't know what it was.
It was 24 frames a second. it had a running time.
My buddy Alex refers to this movie as a movie and does the air quotes every time he calls it that, which I think is about right. I don't know if it qualifies as a real film.
Well, speaking of Transformers 2, that is my number six worst movie of the year. So I think we trashed it enough in previous episodes, including in the first half of our 2009 retrospective, so I'm not going to say anything more about it.
By the way, note to Don Murphy, I loved it. keep up the good work, buddy.
No lolcat for you, you lucky dog. But I'm going to talk about my number five worst movie of the year, and that would be New Moon, unfortunately. I think a lot of people are going to be upset at me for, including potentially some people that live in this house are going to be upset at me for picking it. But, you know, I have to tell the truth. Now, first of all, let me preface my remarks. I've not read the books. I understand that the books are better.
Sure.
Anybody that's read the books and see the movies, whether they liked them or not, seem to say that the books are better. So I can grant that. But the other thing, I'll say something potentially surprising. I didn't dislike the first movie at all, the first Twilight movie. I understood that it wasn't directed at me. I'm not the target audience for these things. But I saw how it sort of worked as a story. It had the gradual discovery of a world of phenomenons and a people that exist within our world but are unseen.
Yeah.
That discovery was, you know, a plot.
Kind of.
There was also some villains in it. There was some romance in it. I could see how, if this is the kind of story that you're attuned to, that you would like it. And so I can't really bag on it too much.
Oh, I can.
But I know you can. I'll let you get to it shortly. But basically I'm saying I respect the fact that there are a lot of people who this movie and these stories do click with. And so I'm not going to be too hard on it. But I can't have that kind of restraint for New Moon, which was a long movie in which, as far as I can tell, nothing really happened. There were three people who are... I didn't really see any discerning personalities. There's this one co-star, this one very minor character who is just a friend at the school that the main character goes to, who has some charisma, a few funny lines. Actually, it was the Anna Kendrick character who features in a great movie
right.
of the year that will be...
Oscar nominee.
Will be right. Oscar nominee Anna Kendrick. Well, she is the best part of New Moon, I think.
And I know.
I was thinking, gosh, why isn't this movie about her?
She seems like an actual human being.
It's true. But that's a common thing, not just with this movie. It's a common thing with a lot of movies where you have these supporting characters who are actually more interesting than the main characters. And I think that's the case here. The three main characters of New Moon, as far as I can tell, don't really have... what's missing here besides, you know,
well,
everything?
I mean, look, nobody smiles, nobody ever displays any emotion other than kind of...
That's it, isn't it? They have the same emotion throughout, and a story
right.
should be fluctuating between a lot of different emotions. And of course, the story puts them in different emotional situations, but they seem to act them out the same way every time.
Pretty much.
Really weird. I mean, you know, for example, you know, the way that Edward Cullen deals with every situation is to look deeply into somebody's eyes. The Jacob character, his way of dealing with every solution is to take off his shirt. So, you know what I'm saying?
I have a real question about this movie, too, by the way. Unclear. So, there's werewolves, which I guess that's kind of a spoiler, unless you've seen any of the advertising for it. Anyway, so there's werewolves, right? And these dudes, they take off their shirts and they run around just wearing cargo shorts when they're in human form. When they turn into wolves, the cargo shorts apparently get, like, ripped off of them. But when they transform back into humans, the cargo shorts are back. So is that part of the power that they have? Like, is that part of the magic, the cargo shorts? Like, is that part of their skin in human form? I mean, maybe I was really bored, so I was thinking about various aspects of it while I was watching it, trying to figure out if that would ever be explained.
I think the Incredible Hulk had that problem too, right?
Well, maybe I think he was always wearing, like, purple sweatpants or something, right?
And they were stretchy. Okay.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was always a little unclear.
Well, I talked last time about the time traveler's wife, and actually they deal with that problem because he goes through time, but his clothes don't.
And he was the Incredible Hulk.
And he was the Incredible Hulk?
Yeah, Eric Bana, right?
Oh, that's right. Oh, my goodness.
How quickly we forget about that
so
movie.
So if he had been cast in New Moon, these problems would have been figured out somehow because he's experienced in this sort of thing.
Right. And you said about the first one, at least there was, like, characters and there were some villains that kind of showed up. Like, here, you need to have a plot for your movie, generally speaking. You need to have some sort of problem that people are trying to overcome, some sort of goal, maybe, you know, move the action from more than two locations. No? All right. I mean, this is basically La Ventura, but, you know, much less interesting.
Wow. Wow. I will say this about this. It is an excellent study, perhaps the most exhaustive and penetrating scientific study ever conducted on the way the human face can pout.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. Yeah. Also, they made vampires sparkle. I mean, I know that we've really defanged vampires, by the way, zing, in the last couple of years, but wow, making them sparkle?
Yeah, to be fair, though, that's something even diehard Twilight fans complain about, too, is the way the sparkling effect is in the movies.
Is that not how it's supposed to be?
Well, I mean, they do sparkle, but I guess the imagery that people have in their heads when they read about it is a lot more spectacular than the kind of really super lame, low-budget sparkle they get in the movies. So,
they just put the stripper body glitter on them, right? That's the sparkle effect in the movie?
I don't know what they do.
Oh.
It looks kind of dumb. But I can see how it would have sounded cool. It's one of those, you know, sometimes books have these things where they sound cool, but you cannot visualize a way that it would look cool. But that's fine.
Right.
Because it's a book.
Until you turn it into a movie.
Right. And if you're making a movie, you have to include that part, because I guess it was really popular, you know, that was a neat scene. So, yeah. You know, you're kind of stuck. I kind of don't come down on the movies too hard for that, because I don't see how it could have been done.
Well, I'll come down on the books from making sparkly vampires. I mean, come on.
Okay. Go for it. So, number four on my list. You don't have a number four, right?
No.
So I'll just continue on with my number four, which is absolutely the most entertainingly bad movie of the year. And I just rank it at number four because I have three that are not only bad but also painful. But this is hilarious. It's called The Wild Stallion, and it is... I see a lot of horse movies, as it happens. But this is one that even my wife will admit it was terrible. She was laughing along with me throughout it. It's one of these really, really slapdash kind of family movies where there's a girl who visits from the city, she visits the country and gets to know horses, and there's a lot of these kinds of movies. Some of them are good, some are just kind of mechanical. This one is just terrible, and what makes it wonderfully awful is the writing. There are some just hilarious lines in it. Like, one of the plot lines is that there's these wild horses out there, and nobody can really tell if they're there, and, you know, some people know that they're there, and they want to protect them, other people want to exploit them, and so the owner of this ranch has taken it upon herself to protect the wild horses, and then somebody comes back reporting that, you know, somebody that works for her comes back and reports that there were tire tracks up there, and so, you know, who was it that was up there with the horses? It could be anybody, and she says, not just anybody, somebody. And it's a very dramatic moment, and I'm thinking, wait, what does she even mean by that? Then there are other, like, supposed comic relief lines, like, you know, why don't you just go amuse yourself with a fly swatter or something?
Is that an insult?
Yes, I think it is, but I don't know what it means. Then there's this great plot twist where some pictures are developed of the horses, and the film canister is set down next to a similarly looking film canister. And so, you know, immediately they're going to be mixed up. And sure enough, the movie makes a point to show how when the girl leaves again, she picks up the wrong film canister. So what kind of a plot is going to happen here?
Ooh.
Yeah, the movie never talks about pictures or film canisters again. That's it.
Huh.
It was cut from the movie or something. I don't know. And then there's this other pivotal plot point wherein one of the girls, the one that knows about horses, by the way, because she grew up on this ranch, learns from a book that horses like carrots.
Hmm.
And so they lure a horse in with carrots.
The sort of information you can learn from books.
You can learn anything from books. I'll tell you, this is a good survival guide from the wilderness. Yeah, so anyway, these whole conversations take place where they try to be clever because the words, that, like, you can tell the writer was trying to write dialogue that read between the lines of what the other character was saying, and so it would sound like a really clever conversation, but you can't follow any of them. None of them make any sense at all, and they're all badly acted, of course, too. So, yeah, terrible movie, but a lot of fun. Do you have a number three worst movie of the year?
I didn't do a list.
All right. I'm going to just plow ahead and
go ahead.
Talk about my number
three worst movie
of the year. And that would be a surprise for me to be picking this, Woody Allen's Whatever Works. Now, I was excited about this because I like Woody Allen movies. Some of them are pretty great. Lately, he's been going a bit off course for me. I haven't liked his last few. But Whatever Works was a script that he had written back in the late 70s, like in the Annie Hall Manhattan era, and then had just never made. And so he pulled it out and decided to make it. And I thought, wow, this ought to be great. He's got a script that he's been sitting on, but that he wrote back when he was at the top of his game. And I just hated it. I will say it's probably the best made movie of the six that I have, but that's all wasted effort because it's really just a lot of... Well, here's the thing about Woody Allen. He has some interesting thoughts about human relationships and stuff, but he's not exactly the guy I'm going to go to for advice on how to live a happy life. you know, hasn't really set the greatest example in his real life, and you know, his movies are without fail about, at least in part, failed marriages. I have a good marriage. I already know more than Woody Allen can teach me about life and relationships, okay? So why am I listening to him? Well, his best movies have a representation of human emotions and the things that people deal with when they deal with relationships, whether they're working or not, and he is able to convey those in a way that most other film directors are not. So that's why his best movies are good. But Whatever Works is not like that. It just really seems to be an evangelism of a kind of anything-goes lifestyle. Yeah, do whatever it takes to make you happy. Well, whether you agree with that or not, and you know, I think there are more important things than just making yourself happy. But even if you agree with that, so what? I don't think this movie teaches you anything. And it's not really that funny, at least to me. Yeah, I just find it kind of pretentious and excruciating. So, yeah, really disappointed. But I got to turn it over to you. Surely you have a movie that you can talk about.
Okay, well, I did see some bad movies that actually stuck with me. Perhaps the most outrageously horrible movie that I saw was Law Abiding Citizen, which starred Gerard Butler and Jamie Foxx in one of these super convoluted... only in movies. Okay, so Gerard Butler is this guy whose wife and child are raped and murdered in front of him at the start of the movie. And then the killers are apprehended by the cops, and District Attorney Jamie Foxx makes a deal with... There's two killers, and one of them is actually more evil than the other. Well, Jamie Foxx makes a deal with the more evil killer to get the death penalty for the less evil killer, and then a lighter sentence for the more evil killer, if that makes sense.
That doesn't make sense.
Well, anyway, he cuts a deal with one of them, so that one of them goes to jail for like 3 years, and the other one gets the death penalty. And to Gerard Butler, this is unacceptable. And it's always that insane movie logic, where it's like, look, we got to cut this deal, or else we won't get anything, Gerard Butler. Like, because, you know, you have no proof that this happened, or something retarded. This stuff always happens in the movies where, you know, Gerard Butler, as an eyewitness, wouldn't be reliable, or something unclear. You know, all the DNA evidence these guys must have... Anyway, so they got to make a deal, and Gerard Butler's like, that's unacceptable. Anyway, cut to 6 years later, 10 years later, whatever it is, and they're executing the less evil killer while the more evil killer is roaming around free. And something goes horribly awry with the execution of the less evil killer, and he dies this painful, horrific death. And then Gerard Butler kidnaps the more evil killer and tortures him to death, and then declares war on Jamie Foxx. And it turns out Gerard Butler was actually, in a major twist, a CIA planner or something like that. He was the guy who ran all these black ops missions, and he's actually super intelligent. And it's one of those things where he gets captured and put into prison, but he's still pulling all these strings from inside the joint, and all these super elaborate plots that he set into motion before he got captured to prove to Jamie Foxx that there's nothing that Jamie Foxx can do to stop him. And it's one of those really just ugly, kind of grisly, grim, really violent movies. But then it also is trying to have some kind of insane point, which is, I guess, that Jamie Foxx shouldn't negotiate with killers or something, and it's bad to negotiate or to compromise. And so Gerard Butler, he's like a bad guy, but he's also a good guy. And it's just really dark and grisly and completely and totally ludicrous. And what's with these movies where like, we have this guy who is so smart he can seemingly predict the future and predict everything that everyone will do to him. These plots that he's got set into motion, like, they hinge on so many individual weird little circumstances that there's no way any human being could have predicted, and yet, you know, he knows exactly, like, that Jamie Foxx is going to order a ham sandwich on Thursday at 11:06 p.m. in 3 weeks or something retarded like that. What's with these weirdo scripts like this? And I don't want to, I mean, I probably guess I shouldn't give it away, but the big twists at the end are even more ridiculous.
Well, I didn't really follow much of your description there, but I have to say that what you said about it is really not making me want to check it out.
All right. Well, that's probably a good idea.
Okay. I will go ahead and not check that out. So I come to my top two worst movies of the year. Number two is going to be Crank 2, or I think technically it's called Crank High Voltage. And I can sort of see the appeal for the first one, even though I didn't like it. So if you liked it, then, you know, maybe don't listen to me. But the first movie was just too noisy and obnoxious and thoroughly unlikable for me. And the second one, well, cranks it up. It is just so much noisier, so much more annoying and obnoxious and harsh and grating and horrible and senseless. And, yeah, I hated this thing so much. Jason Statham, who I've liked in other movies, plays a character who I guess we're supposed to like just because he's the main character, but, you know, the movie doesn't really know how to make a likable character. He's very unlikable, as are the bad guys. They're not the kind of bad guys we love to hate. We just kind of wish they'd all shoot each other and die, and so we don't have to endure this anymore. I'm not going to go on about that too much. I just found it painful to watch and to listen to. So, yeah, Crank 2, my number two. But my number one was even worse because it had such pretensions of greatness. Hard to talk about why I hated The Killing Room so much without giving away what happens, but I'll try. The basic setup is that some people apply to participate in some kind of research, and they're brought into a room behind a one-way mirror, and we're told the story of what happens from two perspectives. One in the room with the people, so we see it from their perspective, and another from the perspective of a new government recruit who is behind the mirror and gets to see what's going on, and she's being briefed about what has happened already. Well, here's why the movie's so terrible. Number one, it's a crock of conspiracy theory garbage. This opening blurb tells us all about Project MK Ultra.
Oh, which no.
Is, yeah, you know where I'm going already. So if you don't know what that is, it's this CIA program in the 60s and 70s that was pretty shady. But basically, it's been the source of a lot of conspiracy theories and speculation on the government doing evil things. And if you want to have the government be secretly evil, you use your Project MK Ultra program as a baseline and build from there. But even in those terms, this movie goes to just the most idiotic extremes. You know, I'm not naive. I don't think the U.S. government is perfect. I actually think it's been as screwed up in the last 20 years as it's ever been. But extreme conspiracy theorists, it's kind of like hypochondriacs. You know, yeah, sometimes the human body gets sick, but don't be an idiot about it. You know what I mean?
Well, the crazy thing about all that is, of course, like, the defining element of the U.S. government is its vast incompetence at almost everything.
Right.
So the notion that it's secretly really, really good. I mean, have we not been paying attention to the CIA over the past 20 years? They're not good at their job, particularly. They're not really capable of carrying out these ridiculous conspiracies.
Right. That's a more realistic thing, but no. Here we're just being evil. So, number two, why this movie stinks. The character arc of the new recruit, who is played by Chloe Sevigny, is one of the worst movie characters in the history of forever. I might be exaggerating,
wow,
but it seems like an appropriate time to exaggerate. You know, for starters, the acting is terrible. I don't think she's a good actress at all, but she's definitely bad in this. We don't get any clues about the character's thought processes from her acting. And it would have been nice, because her character doesn't really verbalize any of her internal thoughts, so we kind of need that. The writing is awful, too, though. The movie continually has her reacting to what she's learning and seeing in inexplicable and nonsensical ways. Like, in particular, she makes a key decision at the end of the movie that runs contrary to anything that's come before. I mean, I can believe that someone might act as she does, but it takes a journey for somebody to get to that place, and it's a journey she's simply not made. So, yeah. I know I'm being vague, but
I gotta ask you.
Go ahead.
First of all, is this a prequel or sequel to The Room?
Oh, if only it were. No. Oh, hi, Project MK Ultra.
Oh, did this movie get released? I've never heard of this before.
Yeah, it did. It was a
pretty
small release.
How did you see it?
I got it out of a red box. There was a woman in front of me in line. She's like, yeah, I heard great things about The Killing Room. I'm going to get that. And so she got it, and I'm like, The Killing Room, huh? I hate her forever. I don't know who she is, but it was a total gutted on a whim sort of thing.
Oh, no.
It was a bad decision. Like, yeah, okay, fine. I'll give it a shot. If she's heard good things about it, I don't even know who she is. I'm going to go on with my rant, though, because I haven't gotten it out of my system yet.
Oh.
Anyway, number three.
Jeez.
Number three. This is some of the most nauseatingly liberal propaganda ever. Now, obviously, that's not going to bother you if you're a liberal. It's not going to bother everybody the way it does me, but if you are a diehard liberal and agree with the sentiments of this movie, you still should probably be offended by it, because it does nothing to help your case. Again, I can't be too specific without giving it away. Not that its secrets are worth finding out, but basically, if your goal is to show how the government and the military is evil, you don't do it by speculating that it might be evil and then saying, see? You know, I mean, you can't just say, here's this far-fetched speculation on what the government might be up to. See what I mean? George Bush stinks.
So are you saying this is actually worse than the life of David Gale?
I haven't seen that one, but...
Ooh, I should check it out.
Yeah, I gather that treads the same sort of territory.
Yeah, well, it's the death penalty. Insane. Insane. That even anti-death penalty advocates were upset by how ridiculous it was.
Yeah.
In terms of being anti-death penalty.
Well, it's anti-death? I thought it was pro.
No, it's... it's secretly anti-death penalty. You gotta check it out, man.
Okay.
Or at least just go read the spoilers on Wikipedia.
All right. Well, anyway, with regard to The Killing Room, you know, even if you strip away all the pretentious moralizing and look at the movie as a thriller, it fails, because it's so transparently obvious that the movie is jerking us around. I mean, there's no illusion that the characters have any control over their own actions. None of them are likable anyway, so who cares? You know, it's the worst kind of bad movie, which, you know, I talked about The Wild Stallion. That's a great, entertainingly bad movie, because it thinks it's better than it is, and, you know, it falls over itself. But this thinks it's better than it is and is preaching to you, so... And it's not technically inept enough to make fun of on that regard. So it's just, it's a terrible time. And let's talk about something else, please.
All right, should we get into good movies?
Hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Do you want us to go through our top six good movies?
Sure, let's do our top six good movies of 2009. Right. Kick it off.
Let me just be clear. There's a couple movies I haven't seen that are sort of in contention for me. So this is my working top six. I really want to see... A Serious Man. I really want to see Crazy Heart, a couple other of the Oscar movies I haven't gotten around to the holiday. I think I've seen most of the first two-thirds of the year. Though, again, I need to see Ponyo and Coraline, so maybe I'm missing a lot. Anyway, Let's see here. For me, my number six movie is, I guess, I'll go ahead and call the first two-thirds of District 9 my top six movie. We didn't talk about District 9.
Wait. So you don't have a top six list. You have a top five and two-thirds list, right?
You
get an incomplete on your homework assignment.
Dang.
This is the second top six list this episode that you haven't finished. All right, go ahead. I'll let you get a full point for it. Go ahead.
Well, I guess if we average out District 9, I guess it still makes my top six list. So, a lot of people loved this movie. I really, really loved it, and then it kind of lost me. It's interesting that there's sort of three really disparate acts to it, and I really like the first two of them. The first one especially starts out as this documentary, obviously faux documentary, about these aliens who are living in Johannesburg, South Africa, and they've been sort of put into this ghetto, and our main character is this sort of mid-level bureaucrat who is going in and trying to relocate them to what is essentially a concentration camp, more or less, and you know they don't take too kindly to it. And it's interesting because, well, for lots of reasons, mainly I like the portrayal of this guy who's our protagonist is kind of a bad guy, but not a malicious bad guy, just an ignorant, stupid little man who is really enjoying his small degree of power way more than he should. But he still comes off a little bit sympathetic. It's interesting, and the documentary stuff really works. And then I can't really talk about the other two acts without kind of spoiling what happens, but the middle act, too, is really, really interesting as our character is forced to confront some stuff, and he goes through, you know, an interesting change on his outlook in life. And what prompts that and how it goes is really well done. Then the last third of the movie is sort of a more standard kind of sci-fi action-type flick. And I guess the last third is not necessarily bad, but it just seems kind of been there, done that, whereas the first two-thirds are really refreshing and interesting.
I agree with, I think, everything you said, because I also was really intrigued by the opening first act. I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
This has a very dry sense of humor. It actually reminded me of the humor of Peter Jackson's early like zombie movies and stuff, you know, Brain Dead and Bad Taste and stuff. Movies that I didn't particularly like, but I did have to admire the sense of humor in them. And this one had the same thing, which is, it's odd. I mean, Peter Jackson produced this, but yep. I don't think he was really involved in the writing. Maybe he was. I don't know. But it was a very similar sense of humor, and but in a much more palatable movie. So I loved it in that respect. But yeah, the third act, it's not there.
Yeah.
It's a horrible ending. It doesn't really resolve anything that's come before. And as an action climax, it's not even exciting in that respect. I thought it was horrible. So I don't think I could include this in a top six list at all. I think it really hurt my overall impression of the movie more than it did for you.
Yeah, well, I didn't hate the third act. I just didn't think it was that interesting. I saw this movie with a coworker of mine,
yeah,
and we had exactly opposite reactions. Like,
really?
During the first third, I was just loving it, and he was bored. Like, this movie's going so slow.
What's wrong with
him? Just won't stop. Yeah, well. And then at the end, he was into it, and I was like, boy, is this movie ever going to finish? So we were walking out, and our discussion of it was all, and it was great because he was just, boy, this looks, that was pretty good at the end. Too bad about the beginning. I was like, what are you talking about? The great thing, too, is that actually the trailers, we saw like the Law Abiding Citizen trailer.
Yeah.
And he loved it, and I was laughing. So we have exactly opposite tastes.
Well, maybe. Is your friend possibly Benjamin Button, though, and experienced the movie backwards?
Ooh, maybe so.
Okay. Well, keep an eye on his gray hairs. If you see him disappearing, then you can be suspicious. My top six list was very difficult because I just found too many ties. Like, well, I don't have ties, but there's too many situations where it just seems silly. Like, is Up in the Air better or not quite as good as Ponyo? I mean, that's a stupid question to ask. So I'm going to go ahead and just list a bunch of movies that could have been number five or six, and that would be Up in the Air and Ponyo, Coraline, My Sister's Keeper, and The Time Traveler's Wife, and I've talked about most of those, so I guess I'll pick Ponyo for number six and turn it back over to you.
Well, I'll be quick as well. My number five is The Hurt Locker, which we discussed, and I think will probably make your list, I'll bet. But yeah, I liked it quite a bit. I guess I didn't like it as much as other people did. I wouldn't have given it Best Picture of the Year, but I also don't have any big problem with it winning Best Picture. So
yeah, I was quite pleased that it won. But number five, Up in the Air... this is the third movie by Jason Reitman, who is the son of Ivan Reitman, but probably gets tired of being credited that way. He's made three movies so far. The first one is Thank You for Smoking, which I remember we talked about in a very early episode we did.
And yeah.
Since then, he did the movie Juno, which I thought was even better, and now Up in the Air. I think Juno is his best movie, but Up in the Air is pretty great. It stars George Clooney as this guy whose job is to fly around from company to company and lay people off. I mean, companies hire him to do the dirty work of actually letting people go. So, obviously, there's a bit of a contemporary relevance here. We're in a time in American history which is not so great economically, where people are losing their jobs. And we're also seeing a disillusionment with corporations. They are too impersonal for a lot of us. So Jason Reitman, his movies are very much about the human experience. Doing a movie that taps into these ideas, these themes, is pretty intriguing, and he does a good job with it. But not so much of a downer as you might think. It is a comedy, essentially, and it's about, you know, this guy who somehow has the qualities and the lifestyle that allows him to do this and thrive even. He has his dream job, essentially. He doesn't necessarily enjoy laying people off. He is sensitive to the fact that you are meeting all these strangers on the worst day of their lives. But as far as the job itself goes and the traveling around and living in airports and hotels, it's right up his alley. And so what kind of a person is that? Well, the exploration of that character is pretty fascinating.
I agreed. I think one of the keys to making it work is that the Clooney character is not a jerk.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily the traditional movie hero, but I imagine the temptation is you make a story about a guy who's firing people is to make him the sort of cold, ruthless, efficiency expert kind of character that you see all the time in movies. Whereas Clooney here, actually, like you said, he actually is sort of sad for these people and does try to make it good for them and make it as easy a transition as possible. He actually believes that he's doing some sort of good work, and he takes his job seriously and he wants to do well. If his own life is a little hollow, it's not because he's a bad person. So often, the arc in these movies about this sort of story is the guy starts off as this manipulative jerk who doesn't care about anyone and just cares about himself, and then, you know, he goes through some sort of typically he meets a woman in these sorts of movies, and then she convinces him to start living his life, and then he abandons his old life behind him and becomes now a good, caring, warm person and becomes a farmer or something. That doesn't happen in this movie. It doesn't have that arc. It has some of those elements, but the arc is very different and goes into some unexpected places, which I found really, really refreshing.
Yeah, and you pointed out something to me when we were talking about this after I'd seen it, and that is that the Clooney character does stop and assess where he is in life, and is it really the kind of life he wants? But you pointed out that it's interesting that that reflection comes from inside him rather than through external plot elements. It's not like he experiences something terrible on the job and that opens his eyes to, you know, the more important things in life. It's just he himself decides to take stock of his life and see what's going on. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Because there are plenty of other forces that could have motivated it, but he's got that motivation all on his own. And there are other interesting characters, too. And we talked about Anna Kendrick. Her character is like the rookie that works for the company that George Clooney does, and she's come up with a way that people could be laid off remotely. And so that would kind of destroy George Clooney's character's lifestyle because he's all about the hotels and the airports and the travel. But, you know, is it bringing the same quality of service doing it that way? Really interesting thoughts that aren't just ideas about the way this sort of thing should happen, but also have impact on the characters. The Anna Kendrick character has an arc of her own that's just interesting on its own.
Yep. And also, I mean, for me, it hits right in my kind of melancholy, serious comedies. So,
yeah.
It's the sorts of movies that I love. So it makes my top six list a little later.
Okay, excellent.
My number four is The Hangover, which I talked about before. And, you know, I saw it once in the summer. I liked it. And kind of thought, okay, it was a fun comedy. And watched it again, like I mentioned in the last episode, and really, really appreciated it even more. So this would not have made my top six list if we had done this 3 months ago before I'd seen it a second time, but it held up. I laughed almost as hard the second time, and I really, really appreciated the performances and the screenplay structure. Thought it was cool to see a comedy that worked on so many different levels. I really admired the movie and enjoyed it, so on my top six list.
Excellent. All right, so moving on to my number four. I'm going to name my number four as the movie Julia, which is a movie I think I've seen.
You may be the only person.
You've not seen it, right?
No, I think you are the only, literally the only person who saw this movie.
Do you think Tilda Swinton saw it?
No.
No. Okay. It didn't make enough
She was in it. Why would she need to watch
That's
it?
That's true. All right. Well, she was in it.
She sure knows how it is.
Let me tell you, the rest of you 6 billion people on the planet sure missed a great, great performance by Tilda Swinton. I thought it was easily the best performance of the year, but she was not even nominated for a Best Actress Oscar, presumably because you have to have your movie seen to be nominated.
I'd never heard of it until you told me it was one of the best movies you saw.
Ebert reviewed it. It was a thriller. You know, he gave it 4 stars. I thought, hey, 4-star thriller. All right, excellent. I'll go see it. I'll make a point to. But it turned out nobody else did that. But I really think this is just a phenomenal movie. And what a character. This is a character who starts off, she's in an AA meeting, not really keen on it. She doesn't really want to change necessarily. She's a drunk. She's a liar, compulsive liar, and plots to kidnap a kid with somebody else, and things go bad. And so she winds up on the run with a kidnapped child. Now, the way the story progresses, there's a lot of conventional thriller elements to it, but where it excels and transcends the thriller genre is the story is really about her character. One of the things that's fascinating is that she is a compulsive liar. She's not really, you know, made much of herself in life, but it is those very qualities that enable her to survive the ordeals that had come up before. She winds up in Mexico. She winds up running afoul of, a larger crime organization. And basically her life is in danger at every turn. And she doesn't really know what to do. The police are chasing her as well as the bad guys. So it's got a Hitchcockian angle to it in that respect. Again, you know, great performance. I do think Tilda Swinton was, even of the last 5 years, I'm not sure if I can think of a better single performance. It's just that good. And so it really should be seen. I hope it will be discovered. I think Netflix has it on instant watch, so you don't even have to use up a queue slot for it.
All right. Well, I'll check it out soon. I guess I should talk about my next film, which we just talked about. It's Up in the Air. So I'll pass it back to you, Sam.
Oh, that's not fair. Now I got to think about, all right, you know what? My top three are all essentially tied. I can't pick between them, but I'm going to skip to my number two, which is the movie Up. Again, you know, it's essentially my favorite movie of the year. Maybe I'm putting it at number two just so I can make good on my promise on an earlier episode that it wouldn't wind up as my number one, even though of all the movies I've seen this year, it's probably the one I'd soonest see again. But I really connected with this, and let's talk about it. Okay, it's about a guy who is, it starts out, he's a kid, and there's a great, great montage that shows him growing up. He meets this girl next door. There's what a huge story is told just in one opening 10-minute montage. It's some of the best filmmaking I've seen all year, just that 10 minutes. Very moving, touches on some complicated themes. You wouldn't expect that an animated movie would get this detailed and delve this much into the human experience, but the reality is it is, in its first 10 minutes alone, a more mature movie than most of the other movies that come out this summer that are allegedly for teenagers or adults. If you've seen the trailers, you know that eventually he winds up having a lot of balloons carrying his house away into the sky, which is a bit of a fantastical turn, and it just gets gradually more fantastical as it goes on. You wind up with, dogs flying planes and all kinds of crazy things. But at the same time, it is still a very human story, and the adventurous elements to it. One thing, I love adventure movies. I love these old-fashioned adventure kinds of things that they don't make anymore, so it was nice to see elements of that in the movie Up. But, you know, for all the high adventure, it is still a very much a human story. It has a real emotional impact. And even by the end, even though there's the action scenes, it's not like District 9 where it kind of abandons the themes to have action. This one is still sticking very much with the themes of the movie as a whole. And also, just for me personally, I reacted on a very personal level to some of the experiences and feelings. Yeah, love it. I think it's I think people who dismiss animated movies as being for kids, and fortunately they're getting fewer and fewer of those all the time, but the people who do that are really cheating themselves out of an amazing experience.
Yeah, well, Up is my number two movie of the year as well, so good time to talk about it. And by the way, I'm surprised a Jungle Adventure played well for you personally. Really, Sam?
Yeah, that's
so out of character.
That is a surprising thing. Yeah, right.
This is a Jungle Adventure that I can get behind too. So that's the real rarity.
Touche.
And yeah, so we got a cartoon in which Ed Asner voices the lead character. So that's interesting. And again, the Pixar folk seem to just really be all about taking interesting chances like that. Oh, I don't know how to really describe Up. If you describe the plot, it sounds horrible in some ways. It just sounds totally ludicrous. It doesn't
work.
And
if you describe the themes, it sounds not fun at all. I mean, it's essentially about an old guy learning that his life isn't over.
Right.
Just because the things he valued through most of his life are gone. And you can certainly be impressed that this is a complex story for an animated movie to undertake, but it doesn't necessarily sound like a whole lot of fun either.
But it also has talking dogs in it, so... and I have heard some complaints about the fact that it gets really fantastical as it goes, and they're talking dogs at a certain point. I think that still works for me, though. It kind of comes in gradually and gets more and more fantastic, like you mentioned. So I guess I bought it, and it all kind of makes sense within the universe of the story and this sort of magical lost world that they go to, which is a really common theme in adventure storytelling. I like that it's an older theme, too, because this is sort of the adventure of an older guy, and this is sort of the adventure that you would have seen in the 30s or the 40s or the 50s, this sort of adventure storytelling, which is fun. I mean, always Pixar is good at going back and bringing up kind of classic tales and ideas.
And it's even more literal than that, because I think it takes place back then, or... No, it doesn't.
No, it starts back then, but it takes
place... The backstory takes place back then, and there's some clips of the movie that look like an older adventure movie.
It's cool. And this fantastic story has one of the most well-fleshed-out, well-realized characters in all of film in this year. Boy, does it work, and is it powerful when it's working?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
All right, so...
You have number three?
Why don't I take... No, I'll talk about my number one first, and that would be The Hurt Locker, which you already mentioned as your number five. And, again, my top three, all virtual ties. But The Hurt Locker really connected with this. For one thing, as I think we mentioned, it works... for me, as an action thriller. It does have other elements to it. It's not, if you go to something that's just an action thriller, you're going to get a bit of a different experience. But The Hurt Locker does deliver those sorts of thrills as well. It is very suspenseful in parts. But what I like about it is that it is also, well, again, very human. And it portrays the war in a way that I haven't really seen before, too. The movie follows a unit of bomb diffusers for the American military in Iraq. In Iraq, there's a lot of IEDs on the side of the road. Nobody knows who put them there. Nobody knows if they're still around, maybe going to detonate them, kill civilians. Who knows? The American military has a unit, several units, but there's this one particular unit told about in the story of this movie that they go out and defuse the bombs. And they, what's great about it is that although we've seen bomb-diffusing scenes in movies countless times, the whole cliche of do I cut the red wire or the blue wire, it does not get into the technical aspects of defusing bombs, which is, I think, why this movie is so effective. It's not trying to make you understand what the process is. It's trying to make you understand how it feels to be somebody who is there trying to defuse a bomb and discovering what they're like. Some of them are buried, they're concealed underneath a mound of trash or buried in the dirt. You have this one guy who's out there trying to figure out where all the bombs are and how can he defuse them all. It's a very uncertain situation, as you may know if you understand how suspense and horror works. It's the fear of the unknown that is the scariest fear that you can portray, and this movie plays off that. It's just unbearably tense at times. And then at other times, it deals with the time off, the downtime back at the base. What is life like? How do these people cope with dealing with these tense situations? How do they wind down? And so that's an interesting thing to see. Of course, one of the opening blurbs at the beginning of the movie is that war is a drug, and we see later on how and maybe even why it is addicting to some of the people who thrive off it. The main character is a bit of a rogue, and he finds that war is a drug, and is not necessarily shared by the people he works with, but it's a really compelling character. I'm not sure that the movie completely does justice to that particular theme, but it does give us a good look. And beyond the bomb thing, one of the great scenes of the movie deals with sniping. There's a way across on the other side of the desert, there's this dwelling of some sort where these Iraqis are shooting from, and we don't really know how many there are, where they're shooting from, why, but from this great distance across the desert, they have to sit there and watch and wait, and it's interesting to see the process of how the military deals with that situation, and again, its effect on the characters, because it is a character movie and not really necessarily about process, but it's interesting to see how the people deal with that process. So hopefully I'm doing a decent job explaining the movie's appeal. I don't feel that I am, but...
That sniping scene you mentioned is one of the best action scenes in some number of years.
Yeah.
Just really great, tense stuff. All right, so I'm going to guess the reason that you played some shenanigans with your list is because my number one is your number three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, though, it might be my favorite movie of the year. I can't tell. I mean, is it better than Up? again, silly question to ask.
I can easily put this as my number one movie of the year. So what a surprise. I liked a Quentin Tarantino movie. Inglourious Basterds is my number one movie of 2009. I don't really even know how to talk about Inglourious Basterds. It's like 17 movies kind of put together, and yet somehow it still works. So we have the story here of a group of American soldiers in World War II who are all of Jewish descent who are going to go get dropped behind Nazi lines prior to the D-Day invasion just to wreak havoc Apache style on the Nazis. And at the same time, we have the story of the Jew Hunter, played by Academy Award winner Christoph Waltz, who is this evil Nazi officer who is in France hunting Jews who have not been correctly rounded up by the Germans, and he lets one particular woman escape. This character, Shoshana, who is now running a movie theater where this new propaganda film by Goebbels is going to be premiered, and all the brass are going to be there, and all three of these sort of separate kind of stories end up intersecting in a very interesting way. And of course, it being Tarantino, how we get to the climax is through a long series of conversations about movies, because even Quentin Tarantino making a World War II movie is going to have most of the characters discussing movies, and we get lots of, and really at this point, if you're going to complain that Quentin Tarantino movies feature lots of unrealistic dialogue and really long shots and stuff, you might as well just stop watching them, because you know what you're getting. So we get, in particular, let's see, there are two really striking long conversation scenes in the movie. One is the sort of initial scene, in which Christoph Waltz is playing this weird verbal game of cat and mouse with a French farmer, and there's an implication that the farmer may be hiding Jews in his farmhouse somewhere, and Christoph Waltz, as the new SS officer in town, is introducing himself to the farmer, trying to be friendly, and yet there is a sinister, dark edge to the entire conversation, which on the surface is very friendly and polite, and Waltz seems pleasant and chipper and cheerful as he slowly probes and goes through this weird dance.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best scene of the year. It's a single scene. It's just an amazing scene, that opening scene.
Yeah.
It's just really, really well written, and there's a series of reveals about exactly... Yes. What they're doing there and what they're really talking about that is that not only cranks up the suspense, but it tells
the story and builds up the character at the same time. It does a number of different things all at once, some of which are, you know, the immediate gratification of making the scene that scene work, but also setting up the rest of the movie. It's very complex writing.
And it lasts for more than 20 minutes. It's a very, very long sequence. And it takes place, I guess that scene's in two languages, French and English, and later scenes will take place in three or four. And I think one of the reasons Waltz won his Oscar is because he has to speak German, French, English, and a little bit of Italian during the film, and seem like the same character in all of them. In fact, I think this movie has as much subtitled dialogue as it does English dialogue. It's for a mainstream, you know, $100 million grossing release. I was amazed at how much subtitles there were. So I guess the other big scene that has just tons and tons of dialogue is, and is less connected to the plot in some ways, more divergent, is a scene where this group of American soldiers is trying to meet up with their contact in a bar, and they've got to make contact with her and then get out of there without it being known that they're actually Americans, because they're going to be pretend to be Germans at this point, and they don't all speak any German. And this sequence goes on and on and on and on, and has a lot of talk about movies, and yet the entire time, even as characters are superficially just sort of discussing this trivia or playing some weird bar drinking games, we're still like, are our heroes going to be discovered or not? And Tarantino just lets it run, and he lets it run and run and run. And, you know, I've heard some people say, oh, you could tighten this kind of stuff up, but what would be the fun in that?
Yeah, really, the whole point of a Tarantino movie is the dialogue. If you're not going to go to a Tarantino movie for the dialogue, then, yeah, I don't understand.
And of course, the movie is visually stunning throughout. There are scenes in it that seem really, really lush. I think the opening, where we see these outdoor shots of France during the war, I mean, it's weird to describe a Tarantino movie as seeming lush, but I don't know what else to say about it.
You know what that reminded me of is there's a François Truffaut movie called The Last Metro, which is about a live theater during the Holocaust, and has some of the similar themes. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Tarantino drew on it for inspiration, but it's hard to tell because he draws on everything he's ever seen for inspiration. But, you know, the lushness and the, you know, running a theater in the middle of Nazi Germany, you know, reminded me of that movie. But, of course, Tarantino never really rips anything off. If he takes something, he does his own thing with it.
Exactly.
Something that nobody's ever done before. You know, I mean, like, the whole movie is kind of The Dirty Dozen. I mean, that's the obvious comparison. But is it anything like The Dirty Dozen? Not really.
And it's maybe the more obvious comparison is the original film called Inglourious Basterds, which this has almost nothing to do with.
That one was directed by the director of Sinbad of the Seven Seas.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Quentin Tarantino can take these Z-grade schlockfest movies and use them as inspiration for these just transcendent films. I don't know how he does it. And here he's got, in the sort of starting the third act, is a sequence that looks as though it's an 80s music video with the heroine getting ready for the big show. What do you make of something like that doing in the middle of this World War II epic?
But
it works, right? Somehow it works.
And it absolutely works.
It feels right.
So I guess I have only one real problem with the movie, and that would be that the character played by Eli Roth, who, I don't know, Tarantino likes him for some reason, but didn't work for me, that opening scene,
the bear
the baseball bat, yeah. First of all, he's a terrible actor. There's a thing about Tarantino where he likes to just, hey, let's have some nasty, grisly, gory violence out of the blue. And he seeks to disturb with that, but he also seems to get a visceral thrill out of that, which I just absolutely do not share. So that's the reason why everybody liked Reservoir Dogs better than I do. I do love, you know, most of his movies. I like Death Proof, even though it's got a lot of that. But in Inglourious Basterds, it seemed like most of the movie was aspiring to better than that and succeeding, and then to have these couple scenes, and then including the very last one, didn't feel like the right decision, like the right tone.
to me at all. Even though, I mean, it's silly to say you like Tarantino and not like the dialogue. It's also silly to say you like Tarantino and don't like violence. But it's just the way he uses it is not always in sync with the overall effect of the film.
Well, I guess I would disagree. I think, I mean, we're watching a story about people who are trying to use horrific violence to scare the Germans, and so... there's a lot of stuff going on.
Right, but there's a difference between portraying that in a way that makes sense in the story and portraying that to your audience. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, this is something violent. I definitely didn't want them to gloss over anything, but it's like, how are you presenting it for your audience to receive? And that is the disconnect I'm talking about.
That's a fair point. And, man, that scene, I think, is interesting, the one you talk about, the introduction of Eli Roth, because... He beats in a German officer's head, basically, with a baseball bat. It's pretty gory. And the guy that he kills is actually sort of an honorable guy, right? He's a military officer. He's been captured, and they're trying to interrogate him for information. And he says, no, I'm not going to betray my fellow soldiers. And they're like, okay, we're gonna torture you to death for it. And yet our heroes are the ones doing these sort of dishonorable thing here. And yet we're also supposed to sort of be cheering the execution of a Nazi. So, yes, it's a weird, complicated... I definitely understand what you're saying. I just don't know that I dislike it. I thought it was intriguing. And I definitely felt both a visceral heck yes, and then I also felt sort of a, ooh, why, should I be cheering this? This is kind of gnarly. And so I'm not really sure there's an easy way to deal with it. I like that Tarantino mixes it all up.
Yeah, I don't mind that he does that. I'd certainly rather a movie try to be complicated and conflicted about something rather than try to simplify a complicated issue. I mean, it's not a simple issue.
Right.
It's hard to know how to feel about something like that. So why should a movie decide for the audience how they should feel? I hate it when movies do that.
Right. And maybe one last comment. It's kind of interesting that the Nazis are the one villain that you can safely just make them all evil cartoons and no one will call you out for it. And yet, Tarantino really doesn't do that. I guess, you know, the upper brass, the upper Nazis, the Hitler and Goebbels and those guys, they're basically kind of cartoon characters in this movie. But the Christoph Waltz character, or, you know, the Nazi that Eli Roth kills, they don't seem... Well, Christoph Waltz is sort of a psychopath, but he's a nice psychopath until the murder that he's, you know,
I don't know about that.
Murdered.
I know what you're saying, but
he seems friendly and pleasant. Like, yeah, I'd kind of like to sit down and have a chat with him. He seems so friendly and bubbly.
Right, but seem is different than is.
Right, but he's also a psychopath. I like that. I like that he's not just some evil monstrosity.
But he is.
Even though he is. Right. Well, okay. Again, in Tarantino-verse, everything's conflicted and mixed together.
I know what you mean, though. I mean, it's not... You can humanize something evil without siding with it, you know? And I think that causes a lot of controversy sometimes. Like, there's a certain segment of the population that's like, no, don't try to humanize terrorists. What they did, you know, in 9/11 and stuff, it was horrible. Well, I think you have to, because you can't just excuse... and brush off the evil that happens in the world, whether it's 9/11, whether it's the Holocaust. You can't just say, oh, they were monsters. That's too easy. You have to admit, hey, you know what? These are human beings. 'Cause they were. And you have to, you know, as best you can, figure out, well, how can evil like that arise within our human race? And, you know... A movie that deals with that question is far superior than one that tries to just say, oh, yeah, they were monsters, they're not like us, so it's all okay. You know, we exterminated that evil, and now we don't have to worry about it anymore. It's too easy to take that route. All right, so that's our top six lists of the year. What else do we have to say about 2009? Maybe a couple of quick mentions about people who died during 2009.
Go for it.
Natasha Richardson, who's the daughter of Vanessa Redgrave. It's funny, I've always liked her, but looking through her filmography on the IMDb, I kept seeing movies that I didn't like, but I liked her in them. A very sad accident that happened, kind of a freak thing, hit her head while learning to ski, and that was it. Dom DeLuise died. Well, how do you feel about him?
I feel like I was a little too young to ever really get into Dom DeLuise.
I actually feel that, too. But, you know, he's been in a lot of terrible movies. But, again, I've always thought he was good in them. I like that, you know, he had a comic personality that I don't think we'll ever see again.
David Carradine, again, talking about people who are in movies that we don't like. Carradine was in every bad movie ever made and Kill Bill.
Right. And yet, that Kill Bill performance is so defining.
It was amazing. But even in the bad movies, he made an impression.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Tarantino does somehow, is he takes these people who should be jokes and makes them real serious performers. And you watch the movie, you think, wow, Carradine's a real great actor. A lot of talent there.
So how about John Hughes?
What should we say about John Hughes? I'm trying to tread lightly here because I'm not the biggest John Hughes fan in the world.
Well,
I kind of like those movies.
Yeah, so I remember in our top six guilty pleasures list, I think your number one was any teen comedy from the 80s or something like that.
Correct.
Most of which are John Hughes movies.
Sure. Well, the other movies are John Hughes ripoffs. But on the other hand, I don't think these movies are that good. I like them, but, I mean, John Hughes' best two movies, in my opinion, are Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which is a legitimately amazing high school movie, and then Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which no one ever talks about when they talk about John Hughes movies.
It's not a teen movie.
But it's a lot better than a teen movies, right?
It is a great movie.
It's way better than Weird Science,
yeah,
for instance.
And, well, yeah, I didn't think too much of that one, but then there's, like, The Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles. I think one of those he only wrote rather than directed, but yeah, I have a much higher regard for him than you do. But it's funny, I didn't at the time. In the 80s, when I was a teenager, I didn't really connect with him at all. The teenagers in his movies didn't have the experiences that I had. It wasn't me in those movies, and I think that was the problem. And as I grew up a little, learned how to relate to people with other kinds of experiences than my own, I kind of came to appreciate John Hughes in his movies a whole lot more. And it's essentially undeniable that his movies connected with a lot of people in a way that other movies were not. And that's pretty impressive, because it's not just, I made a movie that a lot of people liked. It's, I made a movie that a lot of people liked that hadn't really been done before. I mean, the John Hughes teen movies of the 80s were such a far cry from, like, the 50s teen movies, you know, even American Graffiti, moving on into the 70s. Teen movies didn't really tell the stories that John Hughes told and have the kind of characters and feelings that they were wrestling with. So I have a huge amount of respect for him kind of inventing that genre, although haven't really done right by the genre since then particularly either, but I don't know. So I'm kind of conflicted about John Hughes. I know what you're saying. None of them are maybe bona fide classics of cinema, but they did something that nobody had figured out how to do before.
That's true. And I guess they did make a huge impression on a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. His whole generation.
And everyone seems to think that John Hughes was an amazing person as well. So that's something sometimes rare in Hollywood, right? I've never heard any bad stories about Hughes as a person.
Yeah, he seemed to actually genuinely care for the teenagers that he discovered and hired and worked with.
He actually created a lot of careers.
Yeah,
they had no idea.
When they had the Oscar tribute to him, and they brought out so many of the people that worked with him. Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
But what's funny about that is how many people were also missing from that.
Right.
There was a lot more that weren't even there. So anyway, maybe wrap it up for this episode. What do we got coming up?
What do we have coming up?
Well, maybe we should start, I don't know if we'll do it next time or not, but eventually we should start maybe doing a broader retrospective about the whole decade.
Oh, that should be good.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That's a very good idea, yeah.
Maybe we'll split it up into several episodes and talk about different trends and genres. And
Wow, great idea, Sam.
Yeah, it's at least as good as it was when you suggested it to me.
All right, so that's what's coming up in the near future.
Cool, I'm looking forward to it.
Until we get to our retrospective, you can check out the allmovietalk.com website, where Sam has been posting quite a lot of new, weird top six lists that I feel I can't really compete with because I don't have the same repository of movie reviews or everything I've ever seen that I can search for by words. But if you're interested in finding the best six movies with a specific strange word in the title, Sam has that list for you.
A new one every Friday is what I've been doing. And also check out rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com. We got a whole bunch of stuff coming up. My Sinbad of the Seven Seas comic will be resuming toward the end of the month. So definitely check that out. And all right. I'm done.